Hyvää toukokuista perjantai-päivää kaikille. Mukava, kun olette päässeet tänne Ruusupuistoon. Meillä on tänään todella mielenkiintoinen aihe liittyen arviointiin. Eli tämä tilaisuus on yliopiston Education-hankkeen tapahtuma. Ja olette todella tervetulleita. We are really honored and delighted to have you here, Jesper. Welcome. And we have decided that Jouni will present our presenter to you today. But on my behalf, you are warmly welcome. And I hope that this event will be very fruitful for your work. Tervetuloa.
Kiitos, Ulla. Kuuluuko tämä ilman? Ai niin, kun se menee tuonne. No. Sori. Sovittiin, että pidän tänne esittelyn suomeksi, koska silloin mä voin kertoa vitsejä Jesperistä, ja Jesperi ei ymmärrä sitä. So I will tell some jokes and you don't understand. Eli joka tapauksessa me Jesperin on oppinut tuntemaan sillä tavalla, että meillä oli tässä EU-projekti, joka liittyy arviointiin, nimittäin As It Me. Se loppui just nyt vuoden vaihteessa, ja ollaan Jesperin kanssa nyt arviointia, ja tässä on ollut Pasi kanssa meiltä mukana, niin noin nelisen vuotta tässä harrastettu erilaisissa muodoissa. Jesperin tausta on fysiikan opetuksen tutkiminen, hän on väitellyt siitä, ja justiin sillä alalla erityisesti käyttänyt networkia, eli verkostoja. Ja tästä verkostosta voin sanoa, että meillä kun oli Jesperin kanssa yksi paperi yhdessä tulossa, mä näytin Helenalle sitä, niin Rasku Puttoselle, niin Helena sanoi, että tämä kaveri pitää saada tänne. Ja nyt Jesper on täällä. I told Helena wanted to have you here, and now you are here. And mitäs mä muuta sanoisin? Eli Jesper on tämmöinen network-asiantuntija, ja sen lisäksi hän on tutkinut representaatiota fysiikan opetuksessa ja tällä hetkellä opettaa tuolla Kööpenhaminassa didaktiikan kursseja ja samaten on käynyt afrikkalaisia opettamassa inquiry-based opetukseen. Oikeastaan mä en muuta. I think these were all the jokes about you. And then you can, yeah. So you can continue.
Thank you. Thanks. Hi, and thank you guys for coming and thank you guys for having me here. So you have gotten some handouts, and this is because I would like this presentation and lecture to be something that involves you. And because I know that for many people, when I present network stuff, it's kind of hard to get into the thinking of it. So that's why I'm going to ask you some questions in order to make you actually think about it. And it's the first time I ask those questions for those particular networks for a crowd like you guys, so I'm really excited, and I hope that you will try and engage with it, and then we can see what comes out of it. So it's sort of a little bit of experiment. So the talk here is about networks of and for formative assessment, and I just want to go into to some of that first, because in Denmark at least there is a fuzz about feedback. And I'm just going to show you a little bit about that that fuzz, so you can see this. So I'll just make it bigger. So this is not really Denmark. This is just to say that people who write about formative assessment and feedback, they get a lot of citations in the fields. So these are some of the most famous guys. So there's something in the field about assessment for learning and stuff like that. And then we had this Assist Me project. So at the EU level, there is an awareness that formative assessment and assessment for learning is actually something we should look at. And we did that for 4 years, and we found out that assessment for learning is hard. But we also found out other stuff, which I'm going to show you. So now it's my turn to show you something that you don't understand, because this is in Danish. But it's just to show what if you were from Denmark, you would notice this sign up here. Can you see that? Yeah. So that tells us that this is the Ministry of Education, and they are telling us that. And this is from this year, that feedback for students needs to be rethought. there's a language of grades, and that's not beneficial for learning. That's what they're saying. That's what they're saying at the ministry level. That indicates to me that at that level, they know that we have to do something about assessment for learning. We have a culture in Denmark where there's too much focus on grades. And also at the university level, so this was actually at the upper secondary level. At the university level, we have students, it says here, students miss feedback, but do they really know what feedback is? So there's a lot of discussion about what is feedback for learning, and it has become a buzzword. And then recently, I was so lucky to get some data from Danish high school students or Danish upper secondary schools, and you cannot read this, but I'll guide you through it. It is a data set from 2015. 6,500 Danish students answered this survey. And their answers for one of the questions is what kind of feedback do you prefer? So they are also aware of the kind of feedback they get, and they have preferences. They know what they want. And what they say here is that they want written feedback. And the top one is grading, so that's number two. And then oral, and then there's some other stuff, which is we don't know about. So they are aware, and they know sort of they have ideas about what feedback they want and what it is. So, what I want you to do as the first thing here is, because I don't know how it is in Finland, I know how it is in Denmark. So could you just discuss in maybe 1-2 minutes? Do you recognize this picture? First, that's the first question. Second question: could you come up with an example of such a thing in Finland? Go. So just talk to the person next to you. And I'll give you 2 minutes. Going to hand out this, but then yeah, that's good. Okay. Yeah. Okay, so let's hear some thoughts from the audience. I have a lovely assistant who will come with a microphone. And I have time to wait, so.
Forward, so I would say that at some point, at least, Finnish ministries have thought about it and they have done something, and there are experiments around trying to get more feedback.
Okay, so you sort of you've been here and then done it, or is that your claim? Okay. Others? What about the students that you encounter? Do they want more feedback or do they... Yes? Okay. So we do see some of the same things. Okay. Yes? Okay, last chance. Okay. There's one here, yeah?
Yeah, we discussed about that. We think that we still have quite strong culture for grades still in schools. Pupils and students want numbers and grades, and parents, they want grades also. So it's what is reality, and yeah.
There's policy and there's reality.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. Thank you. So there are some problems with giving and receiving feedback, and I'm just going to put this here. And then go over here. I think no. Okay, but I'll just keep it here because otherwise I have to lean in. So we can see it from the perspective of the teacher, from the perspective of the student, and that's of course related, because I mean the teacher is often the one who provides the feedback, and then the student is the one who uses the feedback. But there's a problem here, I think, that is that I might as a teacher give feedback that is intended to be formative, to it intended for learning, intended for you to use it in a forward-reaching manner as a student, but the student will take it as something else. They will take it as summative, as, okay, I just have to align with everything you say. So we can be sort of discussing as teachers and saying, we could do this, and they will just take it as, okay, I need to do this. Exactly this, what you're saying. So there are some problems with that, giving and receiving feedback. But there's also from the perspective of what is to be learned. So it's feedback that for a given. So my topic is often physics. So what kind of feedback will I give in a particular situation to foster a particular type of physics learning? So that's also a problem. These are all related in my view. So what I'm giving you now is sort of my view of some of the problems with formative feedback and assessment. And then, of course, there is a problem of context. When we ask teachers, they will almost always say, the main problem I have is time. I don't have time to give proper feedback in teaching. And so we are on the hunt for formats of feedback that actually allows for that. And I'll present one of those formats here today that we have sort of found out that might work. So what is feasible? But now this, so to give you the model that we have used in the Assist Me project for formative and summative assessment is this. You have some goals, and though those goals, they inform the task that we are giving the students. It could be a writing task, and then there are some goals for that task. Maybe there are course-wide goals, maybe there are country-wide goals, but there is a task. The students, they do this task, and when they do it, you as a teacher have some sort of evidence, some data. So you collect maybe a written report, and that serves as data in this sense. As a teacher, then you make a judgment. You interpret the data. Then there are some decisions about the next step to be made in order to learn more, and also some decisions about how to make that next step. That will result in a new task. So what we're saying here, if we want it to be really formative, we also need to include the student in all these things here. And I have some examples of how we have thought about doing that later on. So this is our model of what we call formative assessment. And this is you can also call it formative feedback. I don't really distinguish between those two. And the intention here is, of course, to help students learn, to sort of point in a direction that this is where you need to go. And it's all done with the student in mind, and we have the student involved in each step. If we don't do that, we can also make judgment based on a broader norm. And this is typically where we grade, or we come up with some kind of report of how did you do according to this broader norm. It could be the course goals, it could be, again, other goals. And that's what we call summative evaluation or summative assessment. So those are the differences. And usually those two don't mix very well, But that's not going to be the topic of my talk today. I'm going to focus on mostly on formative assessment. This model is based on a person called Harlan. So that was formative, but this talk is something about networks of and for formative assessment. So we also need to know something about networks. And in general, what a network is a collection of entities and a collection of relationships between these entities. So here we have some entities which I have labeled A through G, I think. And you can see that the relations go in all kinds of ways, and some are thicker than others, and some, I think that's it for now. And so this is an example of a weighted, because there are differences in the thicknesses of the arrows, and directed network. So that's one kind of network, and we'll have an example of that. So the other thing, you can also remove the arrows. Then we just have a weighted network. We'll also see an example of that. And we can also have just the directions and no variation in the thicknesses. And this is sort of the simplest kind of network that I can imagine, which is just where you have these things here. So you can also think about having different kinds of entities. So I've tried to make those up here. But why is it not working up here? Okay. So now they are different in some way. And the connections can all be of a different character. So these are sort of the possibilities we have with networks. So nodes, these entities that I talked about, we call them nodes. So all these shapes up there, they're called nodes. And the connections between them, we call those links. So that's what I'm going to call them. What is important, I think, about networks is that they're always based on a history. So you might know something about social networks, and they are all based on the history of interactions when you map them out. And every network that I have worked with is based on some kind of history. And they are heterogeneous in structure. So this is one type. If I took another network, a larger network, it would look quite different. It's not a lattice structure or something like that. And the question is when we use network theory in educational research, what does that do? Because it's a methodology or a part of a methodology. And what it will do is it will actually change the way we interpret the things that we're looking at. And something has gone wrong over there, but that's okay. The explanatory models that we make will be colored by this network theory because it's inherently relational. So it will be a relational picture we paint, and that will actually structure the whole thing. And in last year in the Physics Education Research Conference, the organizing committee, I think they actually described methodology quite well. The hallmark of any methodology is that it underpins any theory that gets developed as a consequence of the study, and as such, methodology provides a significant indication of the theory's contextual credence. So what I'm going to show you today is a lot of it has a lot of methodological ramifications, I think, in how we think about theory and knowledge in this field. And we can talk about that also. So here are the three examples that I'm going to go on with. So the first one is what's called the structured assessment dialogue, or SAD. And that's network analysis of formative and maybe also summative assessment. Then there's a written dialogue, which is network analysis of summative and formative use of formative assessment. And then last, module analysis, which is where you try to use a test which is actually summative in purpose. Its purpose is to measure how much you know. But we try to see, can we use that in a formative manner? And those are the examples that are sort of in the handout. So that's the plan. Is it okay? Small nods, good. So the structured assessment dialogue is, we've made a, it's from the Assist Me project, so here we go. So we made a drawing of it. This is this. So the idea is that you have a teacher and a student, and they are talking for 5 minutes. And they are talking, in our case, it was about biology or physics or mathematics. And the teacher had planned the talk beforehand. So it could have been kinematics in physics, for example. And then they had a talk about that. The teacher has some questions planned. He has chosen the student beforehand. And then they have this talk, 5 minutes. It's a very short while. Afterwards, there's a 5-minute feedback session. That's where you have these feedback students. The teacher is then supposed to move to the background and let the feedback students try to come up and say, well, there are some things here in what you discussed that are unclear to us. Can we say something about that? Can we discuss that? The problem here is often what happens is that the feedback students will say, that was really good what you did there. And so there's a challenge in that part of the ritual. Then the next, you can see there are some reflecting students up there. And the last 2 minutes of this dialogue, of this ritual, as I call it, is that the reflecting students and the feedback students and the student in focus, they all reflect on how well did this go? How was this dialogue? How well did we get around everything we wanted and all that? Was I able to answer all the questions? Could I participate in the dialogue? And if I'm a reflecting student, could I have... Is it my impression that I could have that? So there's some self-evaluation in there as well. So that's the structure of it. And if you take 5 + 5 + 2, then that's 12 minutes. And this is how we try to resolve this time issue in formative assessment. It's a very sort of intense experience for 12 minutes, but then it's done. What happens for some teachers is that they find that the students are very, they are sort of on, it's tense. But afterwards, because of the tension, Some of the teachers explained. Then students, they come up, and now it's more relaxed. So now they can ask some of the questions. So there was an opening that we didn't see beforehand, sort of, which might have been because of the tension. Then afterwards, there was a release, and then you could sort of talk about it afterwards. That's what some of the teachers told us. Okay, so that's sort of the structured assessment dialogue. So what did we do to analyze that? So we recorded these dialogues, and here is a picture of one of the recordings. So you can see we can see the student, and we can see the teacher. And now these are 5 minutes, roughly 5 minutes. So we divided it in intervals of 5 seconds. And for each 5-second interval, we recorded what kind of dialogical action was it. So for example, is the teacher asking the question, or is the student asking the question? Is the question, or is the student answering a question? Is the question asked, is that on a high level or is it on a lower level? Is the teacher using what the student has previously said, or is he focusing, or what's happening, and so on? So we had a lot of codes describing each of these actions, dialogical actions. And then what we did to make networks out of those codes, and that's what I have illustrated up here, and I try to see if I can move in a little bit closer. So you have these codes here, out here to the right, and they follow each other. So you can see that they follow each other in some order. And if two codes follow each other, then we link them in the network. So you can see that there's two codes that follow each other here and here, so they are linked in the network. So there's a direction from the first to the second. If a code follows itself in the transcript, then it just links to itself, and it becomes bigger. So that's how we work with it. And here is sort of one of the networks that we got. So we coded for many different things. So we coded for the content, and I'm not showing you the content because the content right here is. That would be too much. Then I had to explain to you also what it was all about. But we coded for the content. We coded for who was active. Was it the teacher or the student? We coded for the kind of statement. So you can see a lower order statement, high order answer, or if the student does questions or doesn't understand. And up there where it says no gesture on the left, that's a mistake. It should say no dialogue. Action. And this is only for the student. We did something similar for the teacher, and the teacher is actually hidden there in that network. But we won't do that here. I will not go through what the teacher did here. Also, we coded for gesture, so you can see either there's no gesture, or there's pointing, or there's some kind of other gesture, which can be doing this, or maybe manipulating with an experimental setup or something like that. So we had that level of coding. So for that network should actually appear in the handout, right? Am I right? Yes. So using the available information now, what I would like you to do is to say, how would you characterize the dialogue in the handout? Go. And if you want me to answer questions, I can go about and do that. Five minutes. It is the same network.
Okay. Yeah.
But it's because the codes each code is sort of a mixture of more than one code. So each of so this one here is both a lower order statement and a pointing gesture.
Okay.
Yeah.
There is time here. What is the order of this event?
And that's a really good question. What you can only say here is that this at some point this was before this one, and this was before this one also. So the time is actually—it's
not presented here.
It's not presented here, no.
So that would also be interesting to know what leads.
Yes, I'm working on trying to characterize it in terms of then you can sort of see when they pop up, and you can sort of it's a sort of a video,
yeah.
But you could also have another. But this is actually different from the time. It tells us more about the structure of the dialogue. Instead
yeah.
of the time.
Yeah.
But you're absolutely right. When you focus on something, you have to do something
yes,
else.
I know that.
Yes, it's one dialogue,
yes.
And it's the same dialogue. A and B is the same, but it's different highlights. So the A highlights something different than B, but it's the same dialogue. Yeah, I know. I'm also just throwing you out, so that's why I'm also going around and seeing how you're thinking about it.
Here's one student.
This is one. Actually, this is one student and one teacher.
Okay.
But as you can see, every time there's a pink one here, then that's actually where the teacher is saying something,
okay.
Or where there's silence. There could also be
yeah.
silence because
yeah.
the student is not doing anything. So you can see that. I mean, one of the things is that you can see that the teacher is actually quite silent. He's not saying much.
Mm-hmm.
How are you doing up here? Okay, so that's why I'm going around, because I know it's difficult. I mean, it's always difficult. Yeah. So the idea is we want to capture sort of the structure of these dialogues and see how and see if we can display them. And it's the same dialogue, those two, yeah. And the idea is then that the big one there. That's where a student is making a lower order statement, but you can also see that the student is pointing. So we have these two things here. So, but when it's when you can also see that when it's purple, the student is not doing anything. So you can begin to see what follows what, for example. And what is the overall characterization of yeah. So I'm inviting you into our research. Okay, so that was 5 minutes. Can I have, again, some people? So I know I was out talking to most of you. I didn't get to get you guys out there because it's difficult to get in there. But what do you think here? What how would you characterize the dialogue? What did you notice? So a lot of talk. It is difficult. Okay, so I can tell you what I noticed, and then you can sort of nod if you agree, or you can say no or something like that. I noticed that first of all, there's a lot of the student is very active. First of all, the teacher, because where it says no, it's where we have these pink, purple stuff. That's where the student is not active. Let me just show you here. Out there. So you can see the purple notes is where the student is not active. And I noticed that the student has some large blobs of activity, which is, for example, the lower order statement in the middle there, where there's also pointing. I also noticed that for this student, it's important to that something about pointing here. That is connected to actually being part of the dialogue. So gesture has something to do with what this student is doing. But what I also notice is that there are lower order statements, and that's what there is the most of, right? When the student does something. So it's not a dialogue which is moves in the higher levels of understanding. Let's say that. That's what I see. Okay? You could also begin to analyze, but that would be on a deeper level. What follows what? Is there some strategy that the teacher is making that seems to produce some of this? So when the teacher asks a certain kind of question, is that then produced? But then we would also need to consider what the teacher is doing, and we did not do that here. Okay. So that's kind of the way we are looking at these dialogues. And what we're doing, how we're trying to do that is in a kind of structured way. So we try to see, so this is one network. Now we have 26 of these kinds of networks, and we're trying to figure out how are they connected. Can we make groups of different kinds of networks? And, oops, we could. And that's actually, and I'm not going to give you an assignment for this one. But the in your next also in this in the handout you can see these groups. So in the handout, what you see on the next page is actually each of the nodes there is one network, and you can see how similar it is to other networks. And when we say similar, it is that, for example, in our case, I noticed that there was a lot of pointing. So some of them are similar because they have a lot of pointing. Some of them are similar because they are on a high taxonomic level. Some of them are similar because there's a lot of silence, and so on. And what we did is that we tried to use, we made this network of similarities, and we clustered them using a computer algorithm, which I will not explain today. We clustered them, and then we have these groups of dialogues which are somewhat similar. Then we try to say, okay, so what is it that makes them similar? We try to compare them. Which teachers did the dialogues? Were the students doing particularly well in some of the dialogues? How did the students reflect afterwards in these dialogues? Those are we try to connect this network stuff with something exterior to the network, which is, I think, very important, because otherwise it's just a nice drawing. We have to do something with it. And so what we came up with is a typology. So we have six groups. And I have not printed that out for you. It's up here. Can you actually read that? No, you can't. But so one of them is the simple talk. So we can see that it has few gestures. There is some student confusion. This is where the student is questioning or not understanding what the teacher is saying. The student is active, and the teacher actually gives space. And we see that four different teachers in upper secondary and lower secondary, they do that. So another one I want to point to is the competent student. There's some pointing in lower order statements, but there's also an autonomous student that acts at a high level. So they would have a lot of higher order statements, these dialogues. And as you can see, four of the 26 dialogues, they are in this one here. And it's enacted by three different teachers in upper secondary: science, technology, and maths. And then we have the struggle, which I think it has no gesture. There's some student confusion, but actually there's a lot of silence. So they are trying to make this, they don't know what to do with it. It's difficult for them. And the reflecting students, they feel that they could not answer a lot of the questions and that it's difficult to use the dialogue to determine the next steps of their own learning. So we ask them afterwards, as part of the reflection, how can you use this dialogue for next steps? And in this particular instance, they could not use it very well. In some of the others, they could. So what I'm trying to give you here is an example of how we can use these networks and couple them with external data to see how can we characterize this? What happens when you do this kind of dialogue? So far we have six, and there's a paper coming out where it's all explained. I could use maybe 2 hours on this alone. So that was the first example, and it will come out later this year. So the second example is something completely different. It's about the written. And this is from our basic science didactics course. I think I heard you only mention that I teach the course. So it's a course at the university level. What you just saw was upper secondary. So this is from a university level course, and this is kind of what happens. This is sort of an instance of this formative assessment loop that I showed in the beginning. And what happens is that you can see that we have some course-wide criteria, and they are reflected in the assignments that we give the students. We start with the assignment one, and then they write a report. Then we give feedback to that report. They decide, they react to that feedback, and then decide for the next steps they have to take in the new assignment. And then they continue. And the idea here is that, as you can see here, I have highlighted three of the five assignments, and that's because we had an external person analyze our comments to the students and their reactions to our comments. So there was an external person who analyzed it, looked through all of them. She did a thematic analysis and came up with different kinds of categories that sort of explained what she saw, and then. Another person looked through the codes and recoded and all these things. So we are pretty certain about the codes, that they are okay. And then we ask the question, so when we give something that we think is formative, first of all, how is it viewed by an external person? And second of all, how do the students use it? And so here are... So this is, as you can see, also a network. So what we did here is that we have the... I'm going to have to move up here because then I can see it. So we have the gray ones, that's our feedback, right? And then the purple ones are their responses. And that's sort of a legend to give you an indication of how many responses are each. So the size sort of indicates how many times did we use an open question. We did that a lot. I really, really like to do the one to the south end there, suggestion for improvement. I like to take what they're saying and then say, oh, but you could also do this, and wouldn't that be nice? And as you can see, that strategy is not maybe not the best thing I can do, because it might result in a reflective response, where they actually reflect on what I say and say, yeah, that might, for this and that reason, we might opt to do it or not. But it may also be that they just align and say, okay, the teacher says it, I have to do it. It also tells me that open questions, when we use them, the tendency is that we get a lot of reflective responses. We also get precise answers sometimes, where we have an open question where we sort of say, so what is the meaning of this in a didactical sense? And then they answer, they interpret it as a very precise question, and then they try to answer that question. So that's where we think we lean more to that they use the feedback that we see as formative in a summative way. We have made a mistake, we have to, and that's, and now we can correct the mistake instead of reflecting more about it. So in the middle there, open question, and then to the right you see wondering question, and then leading question is where I call it guess what the teacher is thinking. So we have some theoretical frameworks, and then we say, so what is this called in the theoretical framework that we're using right now? And then they say, well, sometimes they actually they do something else, because they go back sometimes. Students investigate their own thinking, so they go back. And then they investigate, why did we reach this conclusion? That surprised us. It was surprising that was actually something that could happen when we asked that type of question. What you can also see, and that's the northern part, is that when we write long feedback, so we have really taken care to read through all their assignments, and we have made meticulous notes and said, here is a problem, this is good, so that we really feel well and say, now I have really done everything I could, we get no response. Or we get just some general reflections about what feedback is. So that could be, for some, this is really surprising. That, I mean, because a lot of teachers do that. They, at least in Denmark, so they get 30 student assignments and they go meticulously through them, correcting all the errors and all that, and it's maybe not used for much because it's too much. So that's kind of what you can do. What it also, the last thing this tells me is it's sort of, what's it called in English? It's a space of possibilities. So when I do something, if I do an open question or something like that, I'm not guaranteed to get what I want. But there's a good probability that I will get something that I want. So if I want to get a lot of the stuff that I want, maybe I should consider what I want to do. And I, for one thing, is going to think twice at least before I give a suggestion for improvement, because I don't want them to just align in this course. Sometimes you want that maybe, but in this course, maybe not. So it's a way of reflecting about what you're doing. Okay. So the question is whether I have convinced you now. Do you agree with the patterns I have postulated here? So that's my question to you. So you can look at the the second handout for a couple of minutes and see, do you find something that is peculiar? Or something else? Do you think I'm right when I have given an overview, right? Am I right? We're still writing the paper, so you can actually influence us. And if you want me to, I can sort of move in on these codes here, so you can see examples of them. If you want me to do that, yes. So, three minutes for this. also difficult to follow.
This one. Are there arrows?
Yeah, the arrows, they indicate that we did this, and then this is
but
what we got.
There are not arrows in all links.
The arrows are very small.
Okay, they are there.
Yeah, but there will always be, the arrows will always go from a gray one to a purple one. Because we only analyze our feedback and their response in relation to that.
One way.
Yeah, so it's always one way. And I agree that the arrows could be bigger. But, we are also still learning how to represent these networks. So what are you seeing?
Very strong.
And the islands, and actually there are one connection maybe, but it's so small that we cannot see them in this print. And that's also something I have to take into account next time, I think. But I know. So I'm, and also, so, so there's really, when I do these things here, should I just pick one or, and then really go in depth with that, or should I pick? So I picked a lot. So now you're sort of getting a bombing of. In principle, you could also, because it, that's just a way of delivering it, basically.
So
you could do the same kind of study.
Yes. This is very, very interesting. I'm sure I will discuss with my colleague.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Okay. So you're still here?
Yeah.
Is it easier to work with them than the other network, or is this also hard? Yeah, so this was the dialogue. Yeah, I think so too. Yeah. Maybe I should have started with that.
Yeah, but I think this is quite easy to generalize different situations.
Yeah.
Different situations.
I think so too. Yeah. So one of the things we did in this course is we tried to say that you have to, actually, in order to sort of pass the assignment, you have to actually react to the feedback. So that's what we sometimes do in this course. Thank you. Okay, so I can hear that the time's up for this. So any comments or questions? We're still writing the paper, so please.
One question.
Yeah.
But is it so that it would be recommended for teachers to give open questions, because it might, as a consequence, there might be reflective responses and counter-arguments.
So I can tell you that in our course, we are, I would focus on open questions. Mm-hmm. However, right now I'm trying out peer feedback, so I cannot give open questions. But what I can do is I can then take their feedback and use open questions in my teaching. But I take this to mean that I should not put as much emphasis on trying to make good suggestions. I should restrain myself and then try only not only open questions, but these questions that we know lead to the things that would be my recommendation.
Yeah.
So whether it will work in other,
this is evidence for it.
This is my and I mean, you can say this is for teacher education. Mm-hmm. So it is particular field that it's made for. So we would have to do it also in physics and biology or some of the sciences, if we wanted to make the broader claim.
Yes.
But it's in alignment with the rest of the literature, I think. Mm-hmm. So it some of it is not surprising. I was surprised about the leading question. So it has this character for me that most of it is something I can recognize, and then there are some small surprises which I think, okay, maybe we have to look into that. How about people who are teaching the sciences? Do you think you could, should you ask more open questions, or should you correct the answers? I mean, it's an extrapolation of the results, I know, but what do you think? Oh, yes.
Okay. Well, we were just discussing that perhaps not all learning when they learn, so they don't, not all students are able to talk it or discuss what they learned. So even this critical comment or question that teacher gives might raise some questions which they might think afterwards, but they are not able to respond to it right away.
Yeah.
So this is
in this particular case, it's written. So they get the written feedback, and then they have some time to respond to it. But of course, I mean, the same goes there, but they do have some more time here. Thank you. Okay. Moving on. I'm going to keep asking you questions. Okay, so the final example that I have is what we call module analysis, and we'll go into what that is. But before that, I have a little story to tell you. And it is a story from physics, and it's from the 80s, and it's sort of, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, physics education researchers, I view this as sort of kind of the birth of what I'm doing, at least. So they got worried in the 80s that the physics students in the American universities, they were doing very good at calculations, but there were some indications that maybe they hadn't really understood all the physics, the conceptual and how to think physics. I'm just going to move this out here because it's really annoying. And so they asked the question and they made some studies and tried to figure out, are they actually learning to think physics during physics instruction? The answer was no, they were not. And at least if they came into universities with some everyday conceptions, they were not in general changed. And so what they did learn was something like this. I'm not going into any details, but it's something where you're supposed to analyze the situation, calculate some kind of acceleration, it seems, and then see if your calculation is one of the four here, and then you choose one of them. That they got really good at that. They didn't learn this. So predicting what will happen when there's so this is a very familiar situation for everybody. You're standing in the garden and you have a string and a rock, and you're swinging the rock around your head, and then it breaks. Everybody has tried that, yes? No? I have not. But and then the idea is to say what happens next, and then you pick one of the five answers, and then that's your answer. And they were not very good at that, so they designed a test with these kinds of questions. And it's called the Force Concept Inventory. And it's been in Denmark since 1999, and I think it's 1992 that it was published. So it's been around for a while, and it's actually widely used still, as I assume. There's a lot of data. And the way you use it is this. You take and you give it to your students before teaching, before the course, and you give it after the course. And then you see how many correct answers they have. And basically, so this is before teaching and after teaching, and you have two classes, and then you say that this is good, this is not good. That's the general way of using them. And we try to say, well, maybe we can do something more with it. And other people have done it as well, but we have done it in a way that nobody else has. So we are thinking that these are two of the items in the Force Concept Inventory. And we were thinking maybe there's a connection between how you answer in one and how you answer in the other. And maybe we can use that for teaching purposes. Maybe if we have a population where we see different kinds of connections, we can use that formatively. We can use that to say we want to go in a certain direction with this population here. So here's how we do it. So here's another one of the answers here. And then what we do is if one student has picked both of these, then we connect them with a line which has a thickness of 1. And if it's 3 students, then it's a thickness of 3. And if it's 1,000 students, a thickness of 1,000. So that's what we do. When we do that, so this is how it looks more formally. So we have different students here who have picked different answers. So the test has 30 questions. each question has 5 different answers, 1 correct answer, and then 1 empirically determined distractor. So they were determined in the 80s, and we think they still work. That's the premise when you do this. So here the students have taken or have answered something, and you can see how that this we can collapse these the student to answer networks into just networks of items where they are connected depending on how many students have answered them. So this is how it looks when you are just looking at students and the answers. So here are all the students out. The purple ones and the green ones are the answers. And what we immediately saw here, for this is for one population. What we saw here is that there are some answers that are very, very popular. They are in the middle. For this population, it is after instruction, and it's for Copenhagen University. And these, the ones in the middle there, are almost all the correct answers. So we could be happy, right? We have very nice students, and it's a very effective program and all that. But you can also notice that there are some things out there, the green ones. So something is actually, there's still some residual left. So we wanted to look at that residual. And then when we collapse this network to then it looks like this. And so you can see that these X15C and all that, those are particular answer possibilities. So, for example, 13C, when you answer that, then you have chosen that when I throw up a ball, there is a gravity working downwards, but there's also an upward force after I have thrown the ball, and that force diminishes up until the very end of the very top of the trajectory, and then there's no more. So there is a force in sort of the direction of the motion. There must be that. That's what this particular item illustrates. And then there are all these connections here. And this is, of course, not something we can use, so we have to do something with it. And what we did was to put it through the same computer algorithm that I told you about before. Again, I will not explain what it is, but we can, if for interested parties, we can talk about it afterwards. And it creates modules where each module is, one of them is on the right, has an internal structure. So it's a collection of these wrong answers. So now remember, we only have the wrong answers. So it's a collection of these wrong answers that are in one module. So it has an internal structure, but it's also connected to other modules. And what we get here is sort of a structured map of these residual misunderstandings, if you want to call them that. I'm not particularly happy with calling them misunderstandings because I think that they can be guided in the correct direction. But for now, it's easier for me to say misunderstandings. So that's what we have been looked at. And we found, in this particular study, for this particular cohort, we found 9 modules. And one of the modules is this. And another one is in your handout. And as you can see, there is something here. I told you 13C is this one, right? Where you have a decreasing upward force and a constant downward force. That's the one I tried to explain before. But you can see that it's also connected to something here where there is, and this is the exact way it's worded in Danish. There is a woman tennis player who manages to just exactly get the ball over to the other court by hitting it. And then what are the forces that is working on the ball while it flies? And when you write this, when you pick this one, then you can see that there is a force in the direction of motion. So that makes sense. It makes sense that when you pick this one, you also pick the other one, right? Because that was also a force in the direction of the motion. That was the misunderstanding. And so, again, we get something that is meaningful. We say, okay, so there's something that's actually for this particular group of students who aced the test in general. We still have some residuals. They can still be caught having these thoughts. And you can also see that there are some. We have faded these out. And the reason we faded them out is because we think that they have been chosen so few times that it might just be noise. even though we have tried to correct for noise in various ways, they might just be, but we put them in there just for completeness. And so you can look at these different modules, and there's another module up there that you might can look at. I made these pictograms in the hope that they make it easier to read them. So I hope that's true. But what I want to ask you, and this is my last question for you, how can these modules be used for formative assessment? How could you use something like this? If you have a summative test and you do something like this, how can you use it? How would you use it in teaching? Go. And it doesn't have to be physics. I mean, this is just an example, right? So this one here is that it says here, the question has something to do with forces on the lift. So when you pick this one, you say that there's a tension in the rope here, which is larger than gravity.
Yeah. Okay.
Because there is
because
a...
it goes up.
Yes.
Yeah. Mm. And this one, is it because the truck is the... What does this mean, this image?
So this particular image, it has something to do with, I think, the force from the truck is larger than the force... On the no wait the force of the car is larger than the force of the truck in this interaction. So it basically because this is one of the misunderstandings, because there's a movement in this direction, then my force has to be greater.
Okay.
And that's a violation of Newton's third law.
And this one is this tennis player? No.
No, this is a woman moving a box.
Okay.
And there's something also about the
yeah.
I'm really sorry that it should have been clearer, but it wasn't.
Mm.
Yeah. So I also, because I also knew that we could not, I mean, I could not go through the whole test and so on. So it's more like in general, how would you use these kind of modules? But of course, it's also nice to go into the details.
In order to understand, how can I use it?
Yeah, I understand. Yeah, I get it.
Details.
Yeah. So now I got around to you guys.
Okay. So what are you talking about?
This wasn't surprised the results. I'm teaching second.
So
same
I'm just making a little bit provocative because these, I mean, they max out the test basically, almost, right? But there are still residuals. There's still something left. So I think that's sort of the message I had.
Hey.
Yeah.
they will also think.
Or when I have a coffee table discussion about these things that I have found these, then I find that, okay, my colleagues, they have the same misconceptions very easily. Yeah. So
and I think you're right that the situation can spur it.
Yeah.
I've also had discussions with engineers who thought that if you have a rocket, then you it has to have some earth to sort of push off on. I spent an evening trying to convince him that's not the case. But yeah, so you can really have these very ingrained things. We have used the methodology also on a refraction test that they made in Uppsala University and distributed all around the world. And then we used it to find sort of three different kinds of heuristics for how do people think about refraction. Sort of one of them is sort of that things just move up. One of them is that things move up and then towards you. And one of them is just that, okay, there's a picture, there's a diagram in the book. And that's how it does. So, yeah. Thank you. Okay, thank you. So, any ideas? How would you use it? How can it be used?
Well, we had several sort of ideas. First of all, we thought that you can use it in your feedback for the students. So, for instance, if you have an exam, then you still have a session afterwards. You can sort of focus on the problematic points, since you probably don't have time to go through all them. Then we discussed that if you do the test before the course, sort of like a pre-test, you can then, if you can sort of deduce which are the problematic points, you can focus more time and effort on those during the course than before, than on others, which may be easier. And then third of all, in the long run, if you keep teaching the same course over and over again, then obviously you can always try and improve for the next group and for the next year, since quite often the problematic topics are the same. Yeah. Or about the same.
So actually, one of my bachelor students is now working on data from University of Copenhagen, which is where we have data for the last 10 years. And then seeing, would we find the same kinds of modules before and after? And that would go into sort of the last idea you have here. Actually, yesterday, we have this, again, I'm teaching this didactics course, and I have the physics class, basically. So these are physics students who have taken this course, and then they go to me. And we are introducing new frameworks for teaching for them because they are used to a lot of lecturing. So we are trying inquiry-based science teaching approaches to expand their view towards that. And one of the things we do is that we show it by actually them participating in a lesson, which is supposed to be inquiry. So I did this lesson yesterday, and I actually used this study. I had them discuss. We have these nine modules, so they discussed the nine modules, and then I asked them afterwards, could you actually see a high school class doing this? And they actually said, yeah, why not? Because they are discussing things that they know they are wrong, because we have told them they're wrong. Well, then they can see, I actually think this. So why am I thinking this? And so they can actually spur some discussions there. That was what some of the ideas they had, at least. So I want to test that out, actually. See, can you actually teach physics with this? Okay, so now I've talked a little bit about that course here, and there's a small diversion here because I wanted also to talk a little bit about then how do we assess, how do we examine people in some of the courses we have here, and so for the course, the didactics course. Now you've heard about that a lot, so I want to just talk a little bit about that. So you saw that we have these assignments that they work on. And our idea is that each assignment is not graded. We are not saying this has the grade X. Actually, the assignment is only needed for them to be able to go to the exam. So it's
And the exam questions are aligned in the sense that it is an answer to the assignment. So it's while they have worked with it in a written manner, when they go to the exam, it's an oral. So they have time to present their answer, and then one extra small question that we have. So they go to the exam, they have 30 minutes of preparation, they draw a question. The question is then one of the assignments, and then an extra small question. And then they answer that. And then they do get a final grade, but we delay the grade to the final, most final possible moment. So that's how we do that there. And when we do this peer feedback, it actually becomes much more clear to them, I think, at least for the ones I have now, that they actually also need to learn by giving each other feedback, actually. So that's what I'm trying to implement right now in that course. So they're trying to give feedback to each other so that they can become better at the end by reaching the goal. So we try to align in that sense. And speaking of alignment, then we have another teaching course that I would like to sort of talk about, because we're really, really proud of it. and the reason why we're proud of it is that it's kind of the same thing, that they have assignments throughout the course, but the assignments here are micro-teaching. So they are planning for teaching each other first, and then they teach each other, and then they get feedback, and then they reflect on it. And then they hand in an assignment, which is commented by a teacher, and they do that 4 times during the and it's required for them to go to the exam to do that. The examination is then that we have a contact to an upper secondary high school, and we then go there as a group, and then they teach for a full day. They teach, each person teaches one high school class, and they observe the others teaching. So we're sitting in the back and cheering on, and they're teaching, and the students are thinking that we're a bit weird, but they're doing it, so. but we get invited back, so we're thinking that we're doing something good there. But that's also a way that we try to align what we want the students to be able to do afterwards with the examination. And that has actually also been part of, and is still part of a neutron scattering course that I have been following at the University of Copenhagen. It's basically the same structure. However, they do not have grades at the end. They only have pass-fail, and it's only based on their reports, what they do, on their work. And one of the things that they do is that they go, because it's neutron scattering, you have to go to a large-scale facility. So they go to Switzerland, most of the time at least. And then they do a project. They get involved in the real research. So what they're doing down there is, last time when I was there watching them, they actually found a problem which was something that a real researcher was doing, because they had a lot of eyes and they were confident and all that. So they could actually see that there was a problem, and they could discuss it, and then they had a report about it afterwards. So it was used in real research, and they have found that's actually possible in this course. That I think is a really good alignment with what you're going to do afterwards, and then what you're doing in the course. So that's very shortly about how we sometimes do evaluation examinations, and it's also we also. One of my master's students actually tried to see what. So why is it that it works? How is it? How come that these students, they become so confident that they can go and say to an experienced researcher, "There's a problem there." How can that be? And that's I want to point to some of the perspectives here. And one of the perspectives is, I'm just going to go here because I had not planned to do it like this, but here you go. So this is what she did. The red things here are persons. When it says me up there, it's not her. It is short for mutual engagement, and that is because of the theoretical framework she used to investigate this. She used a framework which is called communities of practice, where and actually she could illustrate. This is one group and one group one group's work with one assignment. So the blue things there are the concepts they're discussing. So planning the experiment is one. She coded that as a concept. But there's also, because it's neutron scattering, there's a source of the neutron and a target for the neutrons. So they'd also discuss that and how to arrange all that. And what she saw there was that the graphs were different, and she could see some systematics in that. So, for example, you can see the tutor 1 and tutor 2, they are outside. So they are not part of the little community that they're forming. But they are at the outskirts. They're there. In some groups, they're very central. But for most of the groups, they're not. And for some groups, every one person is not in the center, but the concepts are. So they're sort of centering on the concepts. And that was quite, she made a really convincing case that you could actually use the layout algorithms that we have available in this to do this, because it was reproducible. So that's one way also of, so I showed this, I was in Miami at one point, and I read this in the bus. And then one lady there, she said, "What are you doing?" Because she saw these strange drawings in my paper. And I tried to explain this to him. So she said, "Oh, I didn't realize that you could map a conversation like that." And I think that's what it is. It's a map of a conversation. So sometimes you have to go to Miami to become wiser. So that's one of the perspectives that I see, that you can use this to map different kinds of things that goes on in a classroom or in a group discussion. Another thing that is more traditional, but I want to make a case that you can use it also for development teaching. This is a high school class, a Danish upper secondary high school class in physics, because that's what I study, physics education research. There's no yellow up there. The purple ones are boys and the green ones are girls. So these here, the notes, they represent students. And just to make a long story short, these the leftmost one is from when they had a lab class, and the rightmost one is from when they had a they were preparing for an external test. Now, we could do a whole thing where I asked you what do you see up here, but here's what I see. First of all, I see that when in the lab class, it's a more dispersed network. In general, information would not flow as well because the groups are sort of just being part of their own group more than they're being part of another group. So, and we can actually show that mathematically. We have models for how information flow in network, and we can show that this network to the left is does not have as good an information flow as the one to the right. And I analyzed a lot of these, and I could see that every time they have a lab exercise, we had this pattern that the information flow was weak. And that could maybe feed into the discussion about what is the purpose and how do you do lab work so that they work. So that's I want to do a more systematic study, because this was one study and I want to do more. What I also see is when they're preparing for the test, the girls are talking much more to each other than the others. And the boys are actually, if you count the arrows, you can do that. You can see that the boys are almost not talking to anybody. There's only one boy almost connecting all the others. You can count the arrows, so to speak. So there's something about how people they do in this classroom when they are engaged in different kinds of activities. And I would like to investigate that further with networks. Then I had another bachelor student, and this is also a very nice story, I think. So I had a bachelor student who analyzed some data that I had from two different years, from 2011 and 2014. And this is for Danish, not upper secondary, it's university first year students, so in physics. And what happens at the first year is that you usually they go on a social trip before they start their studies. Do they do that here? Is there some organized social trips? No, but they do that, and they have a name and all, and it doesn't make sense what the name is called. It doesn't really. But there is a social thing going on before that, and they have done that for years and years and years. I studied there, and I also went on that trip. 1 year. They decided to not do it because there was too much drinking and it was bad for everybody. They decided from a higher place. And so, of course, I had, some fortuitous event, I had network data from both years. So now he analyzed them. And they get divided into three social groups that are supposed to also help them through their studies. So we asked them then, who do you remember talking to about physics, and who do you remember talking to about social stuff? And what we got, this is the year that where we, from one of the years where we do have this trip, this social trip, and I don't know if you can see it, that it says here all topics, so that's both social and non-social. But you can see, can you see that there are sort of three distinct groups that sort of stand out? Yeah. And the labeling is wrong in this figure, because to the right is the talk which is only about physics for that group. So the groups, they are mainly social. It's not that they're not working for something. That it could be that they're keeping they're helping retention or something like that. But it's not for talking physics, because they don't do that in those groups. I mean, the structure is not there out there. It's my postulate. And then if you look at the year where there was no trip, I mean, you cannot see these. So it does have a social function. But we have not. So what we're trying to investigate now is, are there any differences in the academic that are not, you know, visually we cannot see visually, but that we can determine mathematically. So that's what we're doing with this particular data set. Okay, I think I have maybe one last example. Yeah. So actually, I think I'm going to skip that example, because I'm just going to. And Siri wants to talk to me. Apparently, I don't know why. I think I want to leave the floor open to questions now. Because, I mean, I could go on with different kinds of examples, but I think you got the idea that I think you can use it for a lot of things. So that's it for me now, unless you have any questions.
No niin, onko jotain, mitä et ymmärtänyt tai ymmärsit ja haluat vielä haastaa kysymistä?
This is the struggle. There's a lot of silence.
So what I was kind of lacking is how can you use these in everyday assessment? And because I cannot get these networks just... I mean, you have these workshops, of course, but it takes a lot of work, I assume, anyway, so...
So I'm guessing. So the easy answer is that, of course, we do some educational research. Then we use this to get some more generalized ideas, and then they can feed in to. We can give advice to how you can do things and not do things. One thing that I would like to do is to sort of make it easier for teachers to collect, for let's say, social network data, so that they can see. And then, but that would mean that's, again, I could, that's one of the further perspectives again, right? To say, okay, so let's, how is your network of students looking compared to other networks, for example? So making some kind of software that could help people. But you're right. I mean, for the everyday use, I mean, making, going out, going back and making networks, that's maybe not feasible. But it's mostly for feeding in to teaching. That's how I see it now, at least. Hopefully later, something more. Thank you for the question.
Onko vielä jotakin mielen päällä? I think that the... we might need some time to rethink, and then maybe the questions would come later, like Nelly said in her questions, in her question earlier. But for this moment, I think we will thank you. So let's thank Jesper.
Thank you for your attention.
Ja jos haluat päästä kokeilemaan käytännössä, mitä tämmöisten networkien tekeminen voisi olla, niin kello 15.15 alkaa tänään työpaja tuossa Juho-salissa. Ja siellä pääset kokeilemaan, että mitä se voisi olla käytännössä. Ja sitten toinen työpaja on vielä sitten huomenna lauantai-aamuna 9.11 täällä Ruusupuiston Onnisalissa kakkoskerroksessa. Ja siellä ollaan sitten enemmän vielä hands on. Mutta työpaja varmasti valaisee vielä, että mitä se voisi oikeasti olla siinä mun opettajan työssä. Kiitos teille ja hyvää viikonloppua. Jounilla vielä jotain.
Jos teillä on omaa selvää dataa, Joni, niin kannattaa tuoda mukaan ja sen jälkeen, if you have your own data, then Jesper will advise you how to make these networks. That's what we do tomorrow, so you're welcome. And if there are too much people, we can go to the Helena lecture room. There is much more place.
Hyvä. Kiitos kaikille ja hyvää äitienpäivän viikonloppua. Tapaamisiin taas.